Okay, verse 12. Blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord hath promised to them that love him. Now, the word blessed is the same Greek word as in the Beatitudes in Matthew chapter 5. And Kenneth Weiss translates it spiritually prosperous, which I think is a good translation. Spiritually prosperous is the man that endureth temptation. Some people translate the word happy is the man, but I don't think that gives the full sense, really. It only gets part of it. This is more than just a simple happiness. This is a blessedness in the spirit. There's a joy, a peace, a rest, a comfort, and love in this position of submission and surrender. The word endureth literally is remaining under. So blessed is the man that remains under. Or as New American Standard translates it, who perseveres under trial. It's showing that he doesn't turn away from it. It shows that the man must surrender to it. It's something that God places him under. Now, God will only place him under this as long as he can endure it. And God knows how long he can endure it. God knows how much the person can bear. Kenneth Weiss translates it, who remains steadfast under trial. Blessed is that man who remains steadfast under trial. Now, it then goes on and says, for when he is tried, Rotherham translates that, see that phrase, for when he is tried, he translates it, for becoming approved. See, the whole purpose of the trial really is to approve us. God is wanting us to prove faithful. And really and truly, the way trials are set up, they are not set up for us to fail.
Right.
We've got to get this. It's an important thing. God is every day preparing us for every trial that will come. That's why we've got to hear him today, because we don't know what's coming tomorrow. So these things that are coming by the Spirit, through songs, worship, people praying for us, our own prayer time, whatever, they are meant to make us ready for the tests that are inevitable. And the tests, if we are receiving the preparation, when the test comes, we're not going to fail it. It's what happens in the classroom. It's the same thing. We can use a classroom as an analogy. The teacher might have a pop quiz in store. Now, if the student is really listening carefully, really and truly, the teacher will often tip the class off. He'll emphasize certain things, the way things are brought. He's giving all the information so they can pass that test. Whether it's a surprise test or announced test, really makes no difference. But if we're not doing our part in preparing, then how does the trial always come? How does the test always come? So unexpectedly. It always catches us off guard. But see, it's never meant to catch us off guard. See, God is trying to teach us to really listen, to really hear, to really see what's going on. And especially when you're considering what life is like. A trial can come out of nowhere. It can just, where did this come from? How could this have happened? But, see, God knew it would. And if we'll remain faithful to him all the way along, then the test is to approve us. It's to prove that we have been faithful. It's not to prove us as unfaithful. See, that's how the devil gets us to think about some of these tests. Well, these tests are going to come and just prove that I've been a slob, that I just haven't been doing what God wanted me to do. But that is not what he wants the test to show. And see, as we're hearing him and the test comes and we find that he has made us ready for the test, how does that make us feel toward him? So much more love. So much more appreciation. So much more gratitude. And it'll give us better ears to hear as we continue on. Because it has shown us that God is really saying things significant to us. So that's how he's talking here. And it's a very important thing to God. Now, Christ was tested in every way, Was he prepared for every test? Yes. How did he come forth? He came forth pure. He came forth without sin. What did he get on the other side of all of his tests? The same thing we get, the crown of life. Same thing. What he got is what we get. The inheritance that he received is the inheritance we receive. We're to be joint heirs with Christ. Now the Greek word for crown is Stephanos. Excuse me, the word is Stephanos. S-T-E-P-H-A-N-O-S. And it meant two main things in classical Greek. Number one, the wreath of victory in the Grecian games. So here was the victor, and he was crowned with a wreath. He was crowned with a Stephanos. So it shows victory. And the second thing was that it was a marriage wreath that was woven during the marriage ceremony. And also was used, speaking of a festal garland, see, during a time of festivity, rejoicing. It was woven of flowers and leaves. God wants us to have the victory. And he wants us to be crowned for the wedding. It'll be a time of rejoicing beyond words. But there's never victory without the battles. And there'll be no crown without the testings. The testings are to result in eternal life. He is not going to just throw us into the lion's den. You know, one thing, just as an example here, we've got to really hear things carefully. And we've got to get rid of these discouraging things that plague a lot of our minds. We are plagued by a lot of negative, discouraging things. That's the way it is for a lot of people. And as an example, this morning in chapel, a person was giving a good testimony. And they were testifying about really exercising their will and receiving from God and really becoming adamant that this is God's will and I'm going to have it. And he gave an example of this man whose son had been cut on the foot and it started to get infected. And he finally got to a point where he went into the room where his son was and the foot was getting worse and he closed the door and he said, Satan, one of us is going to leave the room before this thing is over and it's not going to be me. Now, the thing about that though that we've got to hear is that there's a lot more to the story. There's always more to the story. You know, you can center in on the story of David and Goliath. And David defeated Goliath. But there's more to the story. Don't forget there was all the time just tending the sheep. Don't forget there was all the time just waiting upon the Lord. Don't forget that there was the lion and the bear. There were all those things that got him to that place of faith. So he could say, is there not a cause? Now see, we can mouth those words and realize there's no power behind them. You ever mouth words? You ever say the right thing and you notice that there wasn't anything behind it? There's no energy somehow? Just, it's not a very good feeling. You can say the words, but the words don't necessarily mean a thing. See, God is trying to get us to these places where we can stand as David before Goliath. Where we can stand like that man in that room and realize, okay, I have power over these demonic spirits and I'm not going to leave the room, they are. But what got that man to that place? All the various tests of life. And all the ways that God prepared him for those tests. And that's what we have to look at. We can't say, well, that's a wonderful story, but I know right now I couldn't do that. Well, so what? What else is new? You may not be in that place. I may not be in that place. But it's where God is calling us. He's calling us to a place of having power, having authority, being able to really go through major tests of life victorious. But he's not putting us there yet. We're not facing a lot of these tests that we're going to yet. He knows we're not ready. That's why the promise in 1 Corinthians 10:13 is such a fantastic promise. He won't let us be tested more than we're able to bear. But we've got to hear him now because he's going to say there is a time where you should be able to bear this. And when he puts us under that and we fall flat on our face, It's terrible then to have to do all that repenting. It's terrible then. He'll pick us back up, of course, but we've misused time. He doesn't want us to be misusing days and weeks and months. We've already misused quite a bit of time, but you know, the more and more we are growing up and we are hearing these things and we're starting to understand it, we're starting to take the right steps with it. And that's what we have to hear in these stories as well. We have to realize there's a lot more that was going on that got that person to that place. And there's a lot more going on in our lives than what we're aware of right now. And you're going to get through some tests that you never thought you were able to get through. But that's because God was doing more than what you were aware of. But see, we've got to hear Him, and we've got to be taking this time that we have right now and really prepare. That's why we've got to keep getting so much more serious about this call of God. But not serious in a carnal way. Not serious in a self-righteous way. But serious according to the real moving of God's Spirit in our lives. Now, this crown of life is promised to them that love Him. Always remember, faith works by love. He's talking about enduring trials. He's talking about those of a double mind, they're not going to receive. So what's the issue there? Faith. And how is that faith going to work? By love. Galatians 5 and verse 6. There is no real faith without love. See, faith really is a deep, growing love, trust, and confidence in God. It always involves love. You can't have faith in somebody without having a love for them. There's got to be a love. You can't just have faith in somebody, really in the full sense and the right sense of what he means by faith, separate from love. It's all tied together in love. It's not something, well, I have faith, but I don't have love. It cannot be. We're talking about a relationship like the marriage relationship. The wife has faith in her husband, and the whole root of that and the whole source of that is her love for her husband and the love that she has felt from him. It's all wrapped up in that love relationship. That's why the devil has attacked and robbed so many of the first love, of just being able to give their heart to Jesus and just concentrate on really that first and foremost instead of all the duties, all the religious responsibilities and obligations. You ever feel just burdened by obligations, religious responsibilities? That's what the devil wants to weigh us down with. But God just wants our heart. He wants our heart. He really does. That's what a parent wants from their child. The parent does not want perfection. The parent is not stupid. The parent knows that there isn't going to be perfection. But the parent wants the heart of that child. That's what the parent wants. The parent delights in that heart. Doesn't matter the failings. That's totally immaterial. Does not matter really at all. The thing the parent wants is the heart of that child. And if the parent has the heart, the parent is thrilled. The parent is satisfied, really. Because the rest will come in time as the child grows up and learns how to be more responsible. It'll always come just as a matter of course of life. Verse 13, let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. God does not tempt man. The main truth is that God is not responsible. This is the main truth. This is what he's driving at here. God is not responsible for the evil that we do. There is a lot of subtle, as well as not so subtle, Calvinism that is holding on to people's minds. And it's the idea of attributing all the problems we face somehow to God's providence. Somehow, in some way, it's still the will of God. There's a lot of this. It's very subtle with most people. With other people, it's not subtle at all. But it just makes the whole of life God's will. Death is God's will. Sickness is God's will. People losing out with God ends up being God's will. All sorts of things. And it can be very, very subtle. And the reason, one of the underlying reasons, is that man does not want to face his responsibility. We want to pass the buck as often and as quick as possible. We must see what our responsibility is and face up to it. See, there's always God's part and there's always man's part. We've got to find out what our part is and face up to it. Man is guilty for his sin, not God. God's not guilty. Man's guilty. You see, God, by his holy nature, is incapable of any contact with evil. He cannot, therefore, be the cause of man's sin. He cannot be the cause. He was not the cause of Adam's sin. Well, he put the tree of the knowledge of good and evil there. He's not the cause of Adam's sin. Adam was the cause of his own sin. Adam can't blame the devil either. And Adam can't blame his wife. Those are not valid excuses. That does not justify him. God setting up the test is not God having contact with evil. To put a tree there and say don't eat it, the tree in and of itself isn't evil. And to say don't eat it obviously is not evil. It's man who decides to disobey. That's where the problem comes in. And it doesn't matter what is the driving force behind that. Man in his will either says yes or no. And that's what it comes down to. And God wants to remove a lot of this pressure and these other things that kind of more or less manipulate us and get us into a frame of thinking, well, there was nothing else I could do. He wants to move that aside. He wants to make the picture very clear. And he wants to make it easier for us to say yes to him and give us more strength to do that. But if we say no, no matter what the pressure and no matter what the situation, we're still guilty. And we've got to accept that. We've got to see that. We've got to realize that that's the truth. God is not some sort of evil tempter. That's entirely foreign to his character and his person. He is not an evil tempter. Evil is not in God. There is no evil in God. God could not tempt you to use drugs in a billion years. It's not in God. It's not in him. Just like as now we're saved and spirit-filled, you couldn't invite somebody over and offer them a drink of whiskey. I mean, it's not in you. It's not part of you. You couldn't try to set them up in some situation and get them to do wickedness. You really couldn't. You know, as you're walking with God, as you're really living out your salvation, it's not in you. It's not part of you. It's an impossibility. Now, if the devil gets you to start making some wrong decisions, well then things can change, of course. But nothing's going to change with God. God's not going to backslide. Not one day going to be good and the next day he's evil. That's not the way it is with God. So there's no evil in him, and evil cannot come out of him to others. It can't. It's totally impossible. Now God does try us for good. See, he wants to bring good out of the tests. The trials which God sends and allows aim to strengthen and purify us. Not to get us to go under. God is like a coach who says, now this is what it's going to be like during the game, or this is what it's going to be like during the battle. So you get over here and you run these laps, and you get over here in the weight room, and you learn how to do this, and you work at it, and you're going to think I'm a slave driver, but when you're out there in the battle, during the game, and you're able to win because you have endurance, because you know how to think, you know how to handle the situation, you're going to look at me and say, thank you. And you're going to realize that I was doing you good. It may not seem that way at the time, but later on, we'll understand it. And that's the way God is working. Man of his own lusts, and also out of his own lack of caution, many times can bring problems, evils, sins, and tragedies into his own life. This is one of the most, I don't even have the words to describe it, but we've got to be people of a lot more caution. And I don't mean having demons of worry and anxiety, but we've got to be a lot more cautious about life. And we've got to instill it in those that we're responsible for as well, those that we're ministering to. Consider all the ways that people die every day. I mean, really consider it. How many people die every day and they never had to die? There's no way they had to die. Look at the way they die. They do some dumb thing. They climb up on the railing at the kingdom. probably half drunk, and the railing isn't very high, and it's quite wide. Big, huge slab of cement. But it's a long ways down to the asphalt. And there's been two that have died this way. And they fell off that. And they fell to their death. What's that called? Lack of caution. That's bringing tragedy upon themselves. It's incredible the lack of foresight that most people have. And it's where demons come in and cloud the mind. So that's what drugs do. It clouds the mind. Alcohol does that. There's demons of confusion, despair, despondency, cloud the mind. There's enough tests without us bringing 15 others in. And we need to say, Lord, open my heart and mind to this. Open my eyes. If I'm bringing things into my own life because of lack of caution, not praying as I should, not waiting upon you, not hearing you as I should, then convict me. It's hard enough to go through the trials that are really your will, let alone the other ones. A lot of people go through trials they should never have. It was never in God's will. And He doesn't want that. So a lot of trials, God, it wasn't any part of it, really. It wasn't any part of it at all. There's all sorts of trials that children bring upon themselves. They've been warned. I told my children, I bet 500 times, walk up and down the stairs. So they're in a hurry and they're in their socks and they've fallen down the stairs two or three times. No, I mean, now they could really get hurt. This becomes a serious thing. And my son right now is at a stage where he is like wanting to investigate. Well, he's going to put his hand on the wood stove one of these days if he's not careful. And he's going to be thinking twice thereafter about investigating without getting data first. But I don't want that to happen. And we're going to start spanking him more over some of the little things that seem inconsequential because there's other things that could happen. And that's what a parent is there for. Because a child is not always able to think. If he's not trained to do it just because that's what's supposed to be done, and he starts to use his brain to decide, he can oftentimes be in a lot of trouble. So that's the way it is with us, too. That's why we can't just trust our brain. Our brain is not sufficient. There are trials because of godly living, and there are trials because of ungodly living. And the nature of these trials are entirely different. We need to make sure that our trials come because we're living for God, not because we're being sloppy. The things that have happened to people, it's heart-rending. Children drowning in swimming pools. I just read about one the other day. Here was this mother, and it was somewhere in the Midwest. And she had put down her 2-year-old child, I think it was. And then she had to go outside and check on something at the neighbor's house or something like that. She went outside, and during the time that she was out, I think she left the front door open. My child was asleep. And then when she came back in the house, she didn't look around for the child. I mean, the child's asleep. Next morning when she got up, looked for the child. Child's not in the bedroom. Child got up. She found the child on the porch next door, frozen to death in the snow. Now see, there really and truly, there was a lack of caution. There wasn't the carefulness, really. Now some things happen, and you wonder, well, how could you be more careful? But I think in almost every one of those cases, there's all sorts of things. Now see, look at the things then people have to live with. Look at what the demons do to their mind for the next umpteen dozen years. You know, I mean, this is really terrible. And this is what happens to a lot of Christians. They're not careful. They don't realize this is life or death. We're either going to make it to heaven, or it's the lake of fire. And there's no in-between. There's no limbo, there's no purgatory. There's no lighting of candles, and buying indulgences, and having the Mormons baptize some relative for you, and all that nonsense, baptism for the dead, utterly absurd. See, there's none of that. You either make it or you don't. And boy, we've got to be serious about this thing. We've got to realize it's not that hard to lose your salvation. It's not that hard to backslide. Look at all the temptations out there. It's like they asked this one athlete who's had a problem with cocaine, which is very prevalent, of course. And he was now, instead of playing for a team in New Orleans, their team had been moved to Utah, pro basketball player. And this reporter said, well, I bet it's better for you here in Utah because there wouldn't be the same temptations for the drugs. It wouldn't be the same availability as down there in New Orleans. He said, oh, you fool. You got to be kidding. I can go out on any street in any town, in any place in, so to speak, the world and find drugs. I can get cocaine anywhere I want it. I can get anything, heroin, you name it, I can get it. That's life. That's real life. I don't know where that reporter was. Some ostrich with his head in the sand. I mean, you got money, you can get drugs. You can get them anywhere. Doesn't matter what city you live in. Drugs are everywhere. And, so you can end up being pulled away in any situation, job situation, doesn't matter. So just to be much more serious about this thing of living for God. Okay, I've got to live for God. I've got to live for God. I've got to hear what He's saying because there's going to be tests. There's going to be things that are allowed, that are set up by God as well as by demons to see if I mean business for God. I better mean business for God. It's going to be tested in the arena of life. It really is. And, you can hear the guy talk the good game. Then you say, well, let's put your money where your mouth is. Let's go out in the court and see. And then you find out real quick. See, you find out. Things are put to the test in life, whether you're just talking out in the world or whether you're talking in the church. And there are things that are a deep concern to God because He doesn't want anybody to lose out. He's not willing that any would perish. But the view is always to do good. So you got to keep that in mind. The view is to do good. It's to help us. It's to strengthen us. It's to develop in us that which will see us through. Verse 14, but every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. And when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. Do not err, my beloved brethren. The word tempted literally would be translated is being tried. But every man is being tried. When? When is he being tried? In the way that he's talking about here as far as being tempted with evil. See, now he's talking about being tempted with evil. See, verses 14 and 15 tie right to verse 13. When is the man being tried by evil? When is Satan coming along? Where does Satan get his advantage to pull people toward evil? What does he have to find in the person to some degree to be able to work with, to pull? He's got to find a lust. And the word lust is strong craving. And here, of course, it's being used in the bad sense. It can be translated in a good sense, and that's, of course, determined by the context. But here, what is it that's putting this man to the test? And when it says drawn away, literally is being drawn out. But every man is being tried when he is being drawn out. Or as Kenneth Weiss translates it, is taken in tow. Is taken in tow. You see, a tow truck takes a car in tow. And this is being drawn away from and out of God's will. There's all sorts of beckoning voices in life. He's saying this to put us on guard. This is why the Bible says, test the spirits. Test those emotions. Test those feelings. Are they really you? Are they really you? Are they God? Are they angels? Or are we having some demons pull? The emotions are incredible. It's amazing the things we can feel. And we've got to be careful that those things don't draw on us, pull us. The word enticed literally is being baited on. Just like we're lured as a fish to a baited hook. The same Greek is used in 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 14 and 18. And in verse 14, it's translated beguiling. And in verse 18, it's translated alluring. See, the devil is trying to beguile us. He's trying to allure us. We have to admit we're not where Christ was. He said, the prince of the world has come to me, found nothing in me. He went around looking for an area to pry into, an area to hook onto, an area to take him in tow. Couldn't find a thing. The devil doesn't have quite that same problem with us. He doesn't. That's why we've got to be so dependent upon God. Because if the devil was just allowed to come and have a field day with us, we'd be goners. We'd be doomed. Now, we're a lot better than we used to be. And we're a lot more serious about this thing than we used to be. And we've been delivered of a lot of things. But we've got to continue on. So we can't get weary in well-doing. It's not time to start patting ourselves on the back. We want to let one another know, boy, I just see the Lord really changing you. And I really appreciate what I see God doing in your life. We want to let one another know that. But we don't want to then take that and sit back on our lees and let the enemy come in and start to ravage our soul. We don't want that to happen. So there's a pull. The key thing that he's able to get a hold of is the fact that we still have lust. We still have the wrong kind of strong desires. You know the reason we still have those? We still have demons in us. We still have demons in us. And we also have that lower nature of sin through acts of sin. We've got some wrong appetites acquired by sin, which really means we've acquired some demons. And those demons aren't all gone. And those things we feel, it isn't just you developed an appetite for that sin. There's a demon there. And even though he might be out, it doesn't mean that he still can't impact us to some degree. He can bring certain things back to our remembrance, and certain feelings back. And, you know, they've worked a long time in setting us up and brainwashing us. And they've been very successful. So this just shows why we need God so much. Why we need His Word so much. Why we need those watching over us so much. He says, when lust hath conceived, and the word conceived here is used in a technical sense of a woman taking a man's seed in conception. And that's what the word is really involving. And of course, it's taking a physical, literal thing and using it in a spiritual sense. And he's saying, now that lust, when he's able to get a hold of that lust, it is in a sense as though there's been a conception. You mix the pull of the devil together with that thing that he found in you that he could latch onto, and in a sense, there's a conception. Something begins to form. Something begins to develop. Now, the pull itself is not the sin. We've got to recognize the pull and fight it. Rebuke it. Get other people to pray with us. Get into the Word. Let the people around us be a safety and a protection for us. Make sure we're not venturing into all sorts of situations that we're really not strong enough to handle. We've got to make sure that we're able to handle certain situations that we have put ourselves in. You know, you can take a job or be in some other situation, and basically you put yourself there. You might recognize right in the middle of it, this is too much. This is too much. I'm not doing well here. The pulls here are more than I can handle. And this wasn't God putting you here. There's a lot of things that we put ourselves in. We may not have prayed about it as carefully as we should have, hadn't got counsel like we should have, or whatever. It doesn't really matter how we got there. But when we recognize this is not good, and you can get out of it, and there's no reason not to get out of it, you get out of it. That's called wisdom. That's part of our responsibility of recognizing I'm weak, and I'm not handling this, and this thing is putting me under. And I can lose out with God if I'm not careful. And people have lost out with God on the job. It's happened many, many times. They've lost out just going home on a vacation to visit their relatives. They put themselves in a situation they couldn't handle. They said, I'm going to be there for 3 weeks. After about 1 week, they should have panicked. They should have said, I can't handle 3 weeks. I've got to get back to church. I've got to get back to Seattle. I'm going to back to where my brethren are. Or they should have got on the phone about 4 hours a day and had people pray with them or something. And it doesn't matter what Bell telephone charges you. It's going to be a lot better than when you stand before the judgment seat and say, and God says, depart from me, you worker of iniquity. I mean, there are very serious matters in life, vital things. But James is showing, just as a child is alive in the mother's womb before birth, so sin is alive in a man's heart before the actual act of sin occurs. See, there's something happening inside first. That's where the conception is taking place. Have you ever felt that happening inside? Of course you have. Did you ever fight it and drive it away? Of course you have. Did you ever succumb to it and then give in to what it was beckoning you to do? To what you already were starting to give in to in your heart? Of course you have. Just, we all have. We've got to learn. But with God standing there as guard, that's why we're to bring every thought into captivity. That, okay, something's happening, and it's real. And now, do I really want that? What's going to be the result of this? Is this going to bring me closer to God? Is this going to help my marriage? Is this going to help my walk with the Lord? Is this going to help my family relationship and calling of God upon my life? We've got to start asking some real quick, serious, sober questions. We've got to get a hold of this situation. We've got to do some praying. We've got to do it now. There's one thing that really impressed me in the cross and the switchblade. And the whole story, of course, was very impressive, seeing how God worked. But with those new converts, there were a number of times where they'd look for Bill. Where's Bill? Where's Sally? And they'd, oh no, maybe they've gone back to the streets. The ones that who really meant business with God, when they couldn't find them in the room and doing their jobs, you know where they found them? In the chapel praying. And they were rebuking the devil. They were fighting that temptation. And they were besieged with a lot of temptations. They had a lot of things from that life out on the streets still in them that had to be purged. And periodically the devil was finding a way to seize on that. And they knew only one way to win. And they found it in the Spirit. The same thing for us. It's not some mental gymnastics that will cause us to win. See, the lust has conceived when a decision is made to yield. And it might be just a decision to yield in the mind, to yield in the heart. But the lust has conceived and is in fact bringing forth sin when there's that decision. It's like there's a line right there in the heart. And the devil is beckoning us to that line. And we can look back on all sorts of different times where this has happened. And we can see where we went over the line. There it conceived. Now it's sin. Whether you do the act or not. Now don't do the act because, well, now I gave into it in my heart, so I'll do the act. That only compounds it. But doing it in your heart is sin, irrespective of the act. And it has to be repented of, just like the act would be repented of. Romans 6 and verse 16 can be noted with this. Then he says, "And bringeth forth sin, when sin is finished, bringeth forth death." This shows the result. What is the consequence of sin? Death. If sin is allowed to run its full, complete course, it will totally consume our lives. And it will not just consume it spiritually. The devil wants to consume our lives physically. Why do so many people commit suicide? A lot of people commit suicide. You know how they do it? They go to the bar and get drunk. And they decide to drive home. And then instead of really being careful sometimes, they drive like a wild man. That's another form of suicide right there. Now, whether anybody wants to label that as suicide or not is totally beside the point. It's just another form of it. And it's another way the devil gets people to take their own lives. And that's what the devil is out to do. He wants to take people's lives physically and take their lives spiritually. He wants to do both. You're not satisfied with just ruining somebody's life spiritually. He wants to kill them. He wants to kill them. The accumulation of sins constitutes a sinful life, which when finished brings final separation from God. Now, he's not saying that with one sin, now you're dead, you lost your spiritual life. But remember, a little leaven leavens the whole lump. And one sin, if it's not dealt with properly, will lead to another. And if that's not dealt with, it'll lead to another. And before too long, you can have, once again, those habits and that pattern of a sinful life formed right there in your heart. And it was never the intent. That's why compromise is such a dangerous thing. Just a little compromise. But we've got to find out the right definition of compromise when we're dealing with relatives and all sorts of other things. Because sometimes what we thought, well, now if I do that, it's compromise. It wouldn't have been compromise at all. And what you did ended up offending them and stumbling them and was completely unnecessary. So again, that's why we need counsel and help from those that have already gone down the pathway to a degree and find out, now how should I think on this? What are ways that this can be handled? We need to keep gathering information from good sources. Death comes when one gives their heart over to sin, not when a saint simply has a weakness in the flesh. But if the person stops battling that weakness and just gives into it, it's going to lead to other problems. And it's establishing a pattern in that person's life that ultimately could cause them to lose their soul. God doesn't want you to be in total despair because you've got one problem in the flesh. He wants you to deal with it the right way. But if you give up on it and don't keep fighting it, it's the kind of thing that can be, it can become more consuming, and then it can lead to other things. So we have to remember, life is a fight. It really is. It is quite a battle. Well, we really wish that it wasn't that way, but nevertheless it is. So he says in verse 16, "Do not err, my beloved brethren." He's saying, now really, consider this, weigh this, pray about it, let me help you with it. Then he says, "Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, and cometh down from the Father of lights, with whom is no variableness, neither shadow of turning." Now he's dealing with tests, trials, temptations, and then he wants us to know that every good gift and every perfect gift, and what he's talking about everything we need to mature, everything we need to grow up. In other words, everything that we need to overcome the tests, to overcome the attacks of the devil, will come from God. Everything comes from God to see us through these battles and these tests of life. And that's what his whole point is. And he wants us to see that so that we turn to him and receive from him. Otherwise, we will not really be victorious. Legalism is not the way to be victorious. Self-righteousness is not the way to be victorious. All of these things tie together. You say, now these are the things that happen in life. Now I don't want you to err. I want you to understand it. And I want you to know that everything that you need comes from me. Everything you need to make it through, to be victorious, comes from me. That's what his point is. That's what he's showing in all of this. And he tells us that he's the Father of lights. And it's showing that God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. So this is an antithesis, a contrast, and further emphasizing what he was saying in verse 13, where God cannot be tempted, and God tempts no man to do evil. How can he? He's light. He's altogether pure. He's altogether lovely. If the devil came to Christ and couldn't find anything in him, how much more God, the devil coming as it were to God, can't find anything in God? There's nothing the devil could find in God ever as far as tempting God. Totally impossible. And then as far as God ever setting up or allowing anything that in any way would be evil or bad, that's impossible as well. Life kind of looks like it's been set up and it's a bad deal. We got an unfair shake on this thing. Somehow we got involved in an agreement that it's not good. It's not right. But he's saying, now wait. Remember who I am. I'm good. And from me only comes good. And even though life might not look so pleasing and thrilling sometimes because of various tests, remember, the ultimate purpose of life is to accomplish good. Because that's all I can do. That's all I can accomplish. You know, if God sets out to do something, And the materials that he wants to use in order to accomplish it will yield, respond to him, and allow him to finish and accomplish his goal. Could you ever label what he's done as bad? You could never label what he's done as evil. You could never label it as wicked. See, you could never label it that way. You'd always have to label it as good. And we really need this revelation. So we view God and his purpose as always being good. And everything that's happening, as he's in control of the universe, is good as we keep submitted to him. And that doesn't mean that each and everything in and of itself is good. That death in and of itself is not good. That tragedy in and of itself is not good. But God will work for good in all things. And there's a big difference there. Some people want to make everything good then. No, everything is not good. A lot of things are horrible. That person addicted to those drugs, that's not good. All those abortions are not good. That homosexuality is not good. That person backsliding is not good. But God will still work in those situations, trying in every way possible to bring good. And that's the view he wants us to have. And then we have a much more accurate view of him and what his purpose is. We're talking about an architect who really knows how to build something. But the materials must say yes. And it may not look all that good in putting together the materials. When you talk about putting together a building, look at all the processes that are involved in just getting the wood. You got to cut down the trees. You got to do all sorts of sawing. You got to do all sorts of things. It's hard. It's not an easy process. And that's the way it is in life. We're those rough, big trees with all sorts of dead wood. And God's going to do a lot of cutting to finally get the boards in shape. And then when he finally got the boards as he wants them and he starts putting them together, then we can really see what he's doing. But in the meantime, it's not always easy to see that. It's not easy to see what all of this work is going to do in making steel until you see the steel formed and then in the building. But if you just visit the foundry there with that intense heat and all the dirt and the grime and all the rest, it doesn't look very good. There's nothing appealing in that. It looks very negative. And it looks like it'd be just the opposite way to accomplish the goal. But see, the people in charge know what they're doing. And God knows what he's doing. This is what he's talking about. And remember, there's no variableness in God. There's no shadow of turning. Once you find that God is good, he never changes. See, there's no room or possibility of any variation in God. When you met Jesus Christ, you knew he was good. He is good to this day. No matter what's happened in your life, no matter what the difficulties, he's still good. He's still on your side. He still loves you. He loves you far beyond anything we'll ever comprehend. God is incapable of change. He can't change. He's a light that cannot be obscured by anything. He's incapable of being changed by the actions of others. Nobody can change God. God is God. Period. God's light of truth and holiness remains constant. He's always the same. Man can do all sorts of things that causes man to change and cause other people to change and all sorts of situations to change. And a lot of it can be for the worst. But that never can happen with God. No matter what's going on in life, no matter what the demons are doing, no matter what the devil's doing, no matter what we do or don't do, can never change God. He's always the same. He's always good. He's always for us. And then he tells us, of his own will begat he us with the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. Now, he's talking here about the new birth. See, his will is regeneration. Not to tempt us with evil. His purpose is never to tempt us with evil. His purpose is always to bring that which is new and life-giving. That's why he talks here about him begatting us. He wants us to know that that's what his will is. It's always for good. It's always for life. It's always to bring forth that which is pure and holy and all the other synonyms that you can use there. And he wants to make us a kind of first fruits. Now, Christ is the true first fruit to God. 1 Corinthians 15, verses 20 to 23. And then the rest of the harvest is to be like unto the first fruit. So the whole point of this is that we are to be like Christ. Now consider what Christ went through. And then consider where he is. Was he tested more than any other man? Yes. Is he exalted higher than any other man? Yes. Well, can we get the picture? So that's what he's trying to get this across to us. If that's what it took for Christ to be there, it's what it's going to take for Christ to have his bride. It's going to take the same thing. Now, of course, not being tested to the same degree. We would be totally devastated by such testing. But testing that we can bear will get us there. But without the testing, we won't. And that's what he's showing here. He wants us to be like Christ. See, the first fruit, you take the first part of the harvest, and let's say it's wheat. Well, what is the rest of the harvest supposed to be? Barley? No, it's supposed to be like unto the first fruit. It's to be just like it. If wheat's the first fruit, then the rest of the harvest is wheat. And so if Christ is the first fruit, and we're a kind of first fruit, that means we're to be just like him. And that's what the scripture talks about. Growing to the fullness of the stature of Jesus Christ. And being conformed to his image. Chapter 1, verse 19. James 1, verse 19. It says, "Wherefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath." When he says, "Wherefore, my beloved brethren," literally, that's the first part of the verse. It reads, "Be you knowing, brothers of me loved." There's something that we are to know. Be you knowing this. It says, be swift to hear. But Isaiah 55, verse 3. Proverbs 18, verse 15. Revelation 2, verse 7. And it would suffice to say, if we all would simply acknowledge that we are slow to hear, that would be the place to begin. And we give God something to work with. We are all so incredibly slow to hear God. We just are. It shows the way the demons have worked in us. It shows the way sin has worked in us. We were slow to hear our parents. We were slow to hear our teachers. We were slow to hear our coaches. We were slow to hear, in the past, our supervisors, people that have employed us. And it's built habits and patterns in each of our lives, much to our detriment. And if we're not careful, much to our folly, much to our destruction. And then it says, be slow to speak. So be quick to hear, but slow to speak. And you can put Proverbs 10, verse 19, also chapter 13, verse 3, and chapter 15, verse 2. The point of being slow to speak is that we must truly wait upon God so that we speak from him. Jeremiah was in a situation just before they were going to take him down into Egypt. He didn't want to go to Egypt, but that's where they're going to take him. And they said, "We'll do God's will. Whatever God says, we'll do it." They were liars. They weren't really willing. And maybe at first they were ignorantly lying, but after a while it became pretty obvious that it had to be knowing to some degree. And they wanted Jeremiah to get a word from the Lord for them. And Jeremiah was more than willing to do that. And he waited upon God. And God did not give the answer after 10 minutes. God did not give the answer after 2 days. You can imagine these people are impatient. These people are knocking at his door all the time wanting to know what has God said. He had to wait 10 days. 10 days. And then when God spoke, it was stay in the land, don't go to Egypt. So what did they do? They left the land and went to Egypt, taking Jeremiah with them. Probably more as like their St. Christopher's medal. It's some sort of traveling protection. Well, if we've got Jeremiah with us, God won't pulverize us down here. He'll be our safety. Well, God chased them down and they were judged in Egypt. We must make sure that we're speaking from God. That's why the Bible says, be not many masters. Stop deciding that you're the called counselor of God. Stop deciding that you're somehow the pastor. Maybe your theology isn't quite as accurate as you think. Maybe some of the things that you would advise people to do are not so much from God. We have got to be careful in this. He says, also be slow to wrath. That means be free of resentment. Do not have ill temper. Do not have hatred. Do not have vengeance. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. You start talking to people and you get upset real quick. Brother, you're quick to wrath. Brother, you got a problem. You can't have just a theological discussion with the people in your dorm, start to bother you because they don't see it the way you do. You start to get in the flesh. You start to get kind of something agitated inside. You got problems. We've got to have a calm spirit. If I teach something in class and you don't agree and you write me a note, you talk to me personally, I get all mad at you. You don't believe what I taught. How could you do that? It doesn't bother me in the slightest. It doesn't bother me. All I'm doing is presenting the Word of God the best I know how. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. And if you can show me I'm wrong, then that's going to help everybody, including myself. That's going to help the whole movement of God. I want to know. But if you're wrong, I want to be able to help you. But if there isn't a calm spirit, can't be done. You don't get anywhere with people when they're agitated. You can't get anywhere. How often has God been able to speak to us when we are really agitated? Prayers of agitation are not prayers of faith. You ever pray in anxiety? That's not what moves the hand of God. You find the scripture, anxiety moves the hand of God. Worry moves God's hand. Worry brings the victory, glory. You ever find that one? Ever find that statement? I never found that. Never found it anywhere in the Bible. Now, there is a time to experience righteous indignation. But that's in the spirit. That's when you go into the temple and run out the money changers. That's when you take the whip and you say, out! Because the zeal of your father's house has eaten you up. So there is time for that, but not in the flesh. We must not make situations like that where we might have to speak forcibly. We might have to speak with a real unction. We don't want to make that an occasion for the flesh. Don't let the flesh, don't let demons take advantage of that. You can put Proverbs 14, verse 29. So a lot about these things in the Proverbs. Also chapter 15, verse 18. 14:29, 15:18. Probably you also want to put Ephesians 4, verse 26.